Ken's problem was he actually didn't write anything when he was 18. That's why he had to change majors.
Exactly.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I am joined, as I am every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke, who has just made it back, I understand, to Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Yes, I am back from the big city, the six, and fresh off a delicious meal at the Calgary Airport Terminal A Chili's.
Chili's.
Yeah. So not the big one, the small one, but
and Ken, I
big on flavor.
That's great. I understand you took your wife to a date at the, which Terminal Chili's was that?
Terminal A. That was the one. Yeah.
Oh, that was the one. Okay, great.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I saw you guys enjoying large margaritas at the Chili's.
Yeah. Yep. Pre-vacation margaritas, traveling without kids too, which is actually, which is always nice.
Yeah. The thing about Chili's is kids don't really have the refined palate yet for the Calgary Airport Chili's. I think, you know, later in life when they can really appreciate it.
Yeah. Those bold Tex-Mex flavors, I think, are really something your palate has to be ready for.
True. So Ken, we've got a very special intrusive feature tonight.
We do. And the first intrusive feature for a while, actually.
It's been a while since we've done an intrusive feature. And this one is, I guess I'll catch the listener up here a little bit. There's a program coming up here at UNB on Wednesday, March 27th, which we think will be in the future. We can't promise that, but we think we're going to get this out so that will be in the future. But and it's called Skeletal Stories, Bioarchaeological Research from the 18th Century Fortress of Lewisburg, which the listener may know about this because this is really a place that I visited as a kid. Did you visit this in your youth, Ken?
You know, I actually think we did. I feel like when we were kids, we did a Cabot Trail drive, and then we like stayed in Lewisburg, I think.
Makes a lot of sense.
I'll have to confirm that with my parents. I haven't been there as an adult though.
Yeah, it's very cool, and I was actually out there too. It was memorable when I was a kid, so it was exciting when my colleague Amy Scott here started doing research and directing a bioarchaeology research project at the Fortress of Lewisburg. That's a partnership between UNB and Parks Canada, who run Fortress Lewisburg, which is, you know, one of the kind of premier sort of workshops for historic conservation and historical archaeology here in the Maritimes. And what this program is going to be is a series of short presentations about the different components of the research project there. So it's got graduate students, recently graduated graduate students, folks from Parks, Amy, all those folks giving presentations about their research. And what we did was we contacted a few of the folks that are going to do their research and asked for a kind of short rundown of what they're going to be presenting on so we could bring it to you even if you couldn't make it out to this event.
Yeah. So a series of really great interviews are coming your way, and Amy Scott, who is the project director, one of the co-directors at UNB, will be the first interview you hear, followed by Mallory Moran, who is the Cape Breton Field Unit and Fortress Louisbourg lead archaeologist for Parks Canada, and then a group of graduate students and recently graduated students lined up afterwards, talking about everything from fracture patterns to studying tourism patterning and heritage tourism, which is, we covered a lot of ground, which was really great.
It is. And I was glad we did the tourism one because it was nice to have a presentation about something that doesn't hurt. It seems to be that, that bioarchaeologists only do research on things that are painful.
Yeah. We'll talk about the multiple trauma visible in people who were probably intoxicated falling off of the fort actually at some point. So that's that does come up in today's discussion.
That's right. A Courvoisier related injury round.
Exactly.
Which we like to bring just to encourage our listeners to imbibe only a half bottle, just like Ken and I do here on the presentation.
And while my kids have made an appearance probably a couple of times, I'm not sure if they've ever, like, their voices have ever been captured in recording. We have the probably the youngest interviewer or interviewee on the podcast that appears at one point.
That's right. So there's a lot to look forward to here, listener. And we'd like to really thank Amy and Mallory and all the students for coming on and sharing that information with you. And I'll just plug the program again for you here. It's Skeletal Stories, Bioarchaeological Research from the 18th Century Fortress of Lewisburg. And that's Wednesday, March 27th at the University of New Brunswick, Fredericton, Harriet Irving Library Research Commons. That's upstairs at the Harriet Irving Library event space. And then for the exact schedule of events or to register for the event virtually, you can visit their Facebook event page. If you just Google Skeletal Stories, Bioarchaeological Research from the 18th Century Fortress of Lewisburg. And we will also drop this in the show notes.
Yep. And we'll promo this on our socials as well, too, so that people can find the links. If you're not able to attend in person, you want to attend virtually. And hopefully this comes out, this lands in time to promo it. And if not, then we'll maybe, I don't know, if are they going to record it for posterity or where it's a live event or no?
I don't know. It's possible after we've done such a good job of recording it for posterity on the front end, they won't need to.
And so there you go. Yeah.
And so, I mean, we're getting two birds stoned at once, as they say in Cape Breton.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Ken. Well, have we perhaps most rapidly gotten to that half-finished bottle of Courvoisier that we've ever made it here on an intro?
I think so. And so, listener, you'll be treated to a series of interviews here. The next time we talk to you will be in a fortnight and back to our regularly scheduled programming.
That's right. In the meantime, Ken, if the listener wants to get in touch with us, where would they email?
They would be emailing to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology spelled Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And I think, I don't know if it's such a habit that I didn't remember it, but as always, we are sponsored by APANB and the University of Lethbridge Shark Exchange Program and the Office of Research and Innovation Services at the University of Lethbridge.
That's right. I think we're a little bit off of our stride as we were introducing these exciting skeletal stories. So, we hope you enjoy this listener. We certainly enjoyed talking to these folks, and we'll talk to you in a fortnight.
Talk to you later, listener.
Dr. Amy Scott is an associate professor of anthropology here at UNB, where she's also a dear friend and colleague, and she directs the Bioarchaeology Research and Teaching Laboratory. She's worked on medieval Denmark and post-medieval Poland, and most recently, the UNB Bioarchaeology Field Program, which is at Fortress Lewisburg in partnership with Parks Canada. And that also, she also runs the UNB Bioarchaeology Research and Teaching, or BART Lab. Her research interests include biochemical analyses of ancient proteins, social bioarchaeology and the lived experience, mortuary patterning and spatial analysis, identity and age and burial context, and bioarchaeological ethics and excavation standards. She has had recent or forthcoming papers. She's had a lot of papers. These are just the really recent ones in the Canadian Journal of Archaeology, International Journal of Paleopathology, Historical Archaeology, and a whole bunch of other venues. And she's co-edited a pair of volumes. First, The Odd, The Unusual, and The Strange, Bioarchaeological Explorations of Atypical Burials, and then The Anthropology of the Fetus, which is really interesting, actually, Biology, Culture, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, Amy, to talk about your upcoming event.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the NB Arc Pod.
Thanks so much for having me, fellas. I'm thrilled to be here. It's a great podcast, so I've been honored that you asked me to come out today and talk a little bit about Lewisburg.
Thank you so much. Could you tell us first, before we start, about the upcoming program here at the Harriet Irving Library?
Sure. So next Wednesday, so March 27th, we have a research showcase called Skeletal Stories. And essentially what it's going to be is a review of the research that we've done to date at the Fortress of Lewisburg. So most of the talks are done by the grad students who've been involved in the work from the very beginning, but also some of my colleagues as well. So it is going to be a really good event, a nice sort of introduction to bioarchaeology for the general public, as we've aimed the showcase very much towards a general audience. Because that's a big part of what we want to do is share the work beyond just the borders of academia, which I think is a really important part of what we're trying to do with Parks Canada.
That's great. And actually, Ken and I, the listener knows that we do the interviews out of order and splice them together, but we were very impressed by the interviews we did yesterday. And actually, we were talking about how one of the things we respect by with your students is first that they can all do the elevator pitch type thing where they can talk for a few minutes about their research. And we figure this is largely due to your tutelage. But they also all seem to know exactly where their work kind of fits into the broader project. And so to this is foreshadowing that because we're stepping out of time here. Could you tell our listener a general overview of the project and of how it came to be, what it is?
Sure, absolutely. So we actually started this project with Parks Canada back in 2016 when I started at the University of New Brunswick, the same time you actually started. And essentially, it was all sort of perfect. The stars aligned, I like to say. Essentially, when I started at UNB, I really was interested in developing a field program. And just by happenstance, the previous archaeologist at the Fortress of Lewisburg had been to UNB and had done a talk about the ongoing coastal erosion happening at the site. And that there was a cemetery sort of in great risk of being destroyed through this ongoing coastal erosion due to climate change. And so when I started at UNB, I wanted to run sort of a field program. And once I heard about this issue at the Fortress of Lewisburg, I reached out to Parks Canada, and that really got sort of the wheels in motion. It put me in touch with Dr. David Ebert, who worked at Parks Canada at the Fortress of Lewisburg site at the time, who conveniently was also an archaeologist. So we started talking about what the possibilities were. And then from there, it essentially just sort of flowed quite naturally. You know, we established a research partnership with Parks Canada. And then we went and started to develop what this would look like on the ground in terms of running a field program and if we could give sort of these unique opportunities to students who are interested in bioarchaeology. So essentially, it all sprung up from me starting at UNB and a lecture that was talking about coastal erosion and climate change and just sort of following that thread all the way through up to the top at Parks Canada and then developing the program from there. So once it was established and on the ground, we've started sort of systematic excavation every summer from 2017 forward. And essentially what we do is we bring undergraduate and graduate students who have some kind of interest in bioarchaeology. So we have some archaeologists, historians, classicists, anyone who's really interested in coming out. And then we run a 4-week program on the ground excavating the Rochford Point Cemetery, which is the portion of the site that is most at risk of this coastal erosion, just simply because there aren't any other sort of measures that can be used to mitigate this rapid destruction of the cemetery site. And that's essentially what we've been doing the last, you know, 5-6 years now.
That's a great project.
In terms of the scale of the space that we're talking about, like how big is, so the listener that might not know their Cape Breton geography, how big of an area are we talking about that is potentially threatened to kind of get cut off from the rest of the site?
So that's a great question. I'm probably not the one to give you the exact measurements of Rochford Point, but just to give folks a general idea of the scale of how big Lewisburg is in and of itself. In the 18th century, when Lewisburg was sort of at its height in terms of being an early colonial, French colonial site in Atlantic Canada, it was the third busiest and largest port in North America. So we're talking about a huge site itself. And so Rochford Point is a very small peninsula that sort of juts off to the east of the whole site itself. In terms of what's been lost on Rochford Point, interestingly enough, when we talk about sort of the coastal erosion, arguments have been made that coastal erosion started as early as the 18th century because some of the big, large beach stones or beach cobbles were actually used at the time as ballast for the ships. So they were already removing part of the landmass at that time. And then since then, with climate change and sort of these larger storm surges coming in, it's gotten worse. But it looks, based on sort of the Canadian Geologic Society and the work they've done, that we've lost about 32 meters of shoreline. When we're talking about the size of Rochford Point from sort of the Atlantic side to the harbor side, we're maybe looking at, I don't know, I'd want to say maybe 100 meters across. It's not a huge chunk of land. And every time there's, you know, a storm surge, particularly during hurricane season, we lose more and more of that. So it's really not a very large landmass compared to the overall site and how big it is.
Yeah. And potentially a massive loss very rapidly. Like if you're talking 30 some odd meters of shoreline loss in the last couple hundred years, that's insane. Mm-hmm.
It is. And I know that in particular in 2022, when Hurricane Fiona came in, it was devastating to Rochford Point. We could see sort of the eye of the storm was going to hit Lewisburg, and obviously it did massive destruction in Prince Edward Island, but also Cape Breton, but it sort of went right over the fortress of Lewisburg. And Rochford Point was, for a time, the surge had come in and it actually was cut off from the mainland completely. So our access road was cut off completely. We had to wait for the water to recede. And then we saw that the beach cobbles were thrown up over actually the entire point. So we lost, you know, Dr. Mallory Moran, who's the archaeologist, for the Cape Breton field unit, but works at the Fortress of Lewisburg as well. She predicted we lost probably about 10 meters of shoreline just from Fiona.
Oh, wow.
From one storm event. That's incredible. Yeah.
That's horrifying. And so that's some of the impetus for this project, right? Is that you all are really mitigating this against this incredible, urgent heritage crisis. We understand that's some of why you're excavating there and excavating these human remains, but we wondered if you could just sort of walk the listener through some of the things you're doing to work with descendant communities who are buried at the fortress, who those folks were, and what just some of the ethical concerns that you all take into place, because I know that this is one of the areas in which you've done a lot of work.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Gabe. It's, you know, for us, I think it's really important when we talk about bioarchaeology, you know, certainly there's the allure when people think, oh, you're working with skeletal remains and, you know, what can we tell about these individuals? But for us, it's really important to reiterate that we're not excavating the cemetery for excavation's sake. We very much are guided by, you know, Parks Canada and what the local community has asked of us. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, Parks Canada has been taking sort of these great steps to try and mitigate coastal erosion of the main site itself. So we've seen the introduction of rock groins on the harbor side to help with tidal flows and wiping out Barrier Beach. And then we've also seen the installation of armor stone along the Atlantic side of the main site. But as I said, unfortunately for Rochford Point, just sort of the nature of how it's positioned and what the site looks like, it's really difficult to try and mitigate that coastal erosion. So really the only option is to excavate. And that's sort of where we came in, or why this project even came about. So in terms of the steps that we've taken in dealing with sort of human remains, and that is sort of the main focus, is Parks Canada has a cemeteries and management directive in terms of what we do at Parks Canada sites when burials or cemeteries or human remains are sort of encountered. And so part of that is reaching out to the local community. So for us, we've worked very closely with the Anglican and Catholic Diocese of Nova Scotia and PEI. They're sort of joined. And so we've worked closely with them, and they were part of making that initial decision to move forward with excavation. And so for us, we've worked closely with them to sort of get the ball rolling. And then as the excavation has continued, one of the things we've also done is we've reached out to the Mi'kmaq chiefs of Nova Scotia in case we do come across any Indigenous remains. And we have had an instance where a couple of the burials were a bit suspicious based on artifacts. So in addition to the Parks Canada sort of cemetery management directive, we've also been in touch with, as I said, sort of the local community, so the Anglican and the Catholic diocese, but we've also worked closely with the Indigenous liaisons that work at Parks Canada. So in particular, Lindsay Marshall has been a really positive guiding force for us in terms of sort of that Indigenous engagement and making sure that if we come across any remains or burials that we might think have Indigenous ties, that we sort of stop work, we reach out to Lindsay Marshall as that Indigenous liaison and sort of take guidance from him. Now, in the past, we've had a couple of burials where some of the artifacts in with the individuals have tipped us off that they may have some kind of Indigenous tie to them. And so at that point, we reached out to Lindsay Marshall, and then we're directed to the Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq chiefs. And then at the time when Dr. David Ebert was there, him and I met with them and sort of went over what they would like us to do. So in terms of the remains, do we continue to excavate or do we leave them in situ? You know, what is the sort of request of the community? So we've stayed in close contact since those initial couple of examples, and we've been very careful as we continue to excavate to make sure that if anything appears to be non sort of European in origin. We want to make sure that we're including the indigenous community, because we certainly know that while historically the cemetery has been noted as primarily individuals of European descent, so we're talking about the French and then the English when they occupied the fortress, we can't say for sure. So there may be individuals that are part of this cemetery that fall outside of that sort of rough ancestral boundary, and we want to make sure we're being respectful of that. So we've really tried to ensure that we bring in sort of that indigenous consultation. And at the beginning of every field season, Lindsay Marshall comes out and he'll do a smudge at the site, again making sure that we're being respectful of these communities and what they want to see in terms of us exhuming any ancestors, and then what the next steps are. So we've been very conscious of that, and I think that's a big part of BioArc and where we're really moving in the future. You know, I look at myself as sort of a white settler woman. You know, for me to make those decisions, I simply can't. I need consultation, and I need to ask what people are looking for. And I think that, you know, in BioArc, we need to hold ourselves to that sort of higher ethical standard, because it's an important part of what we do. We're working with human remains, and, you know, they're not objects, they're people, and we need to treat them as such. So that's what we're really trying to aim for, working with the Catholic and Anglican diocese, but also the Indigenous liaisons as well.
That's great.
That's great. And I feel like because you're one of only a handful of bioarchaeology field schools in North America. Is that right, Amy?
So we're the only bioarch field school in Canada. I know that. In terms of into the U.S. as well, I'm not sure, but I think we're one of the only ones that is currently operating.
That's great. So it's really imparting that framework on the next generation.
Yeah, I think we even had a student from ULETH go to your bioarch field school. Did we not? Recently, or maybe they're going this year. I don't know. It's come up. Like we get advertisements actually through our through the email server at University of Lethbridge. So
excellent, the marketing is working. All the emails that I send out, they're not going into the void. We certainly have had students from all across Canada come to the program. And then we've had students from down in the US as well. So we've been very successful at sort of reaching a wider audience beyond just UNB. I'm thrilled we have UNB students that want to come and are interested, but we have been sort of reaching a further audience. So that does sound familiar. I'd have to sort of look through the records again, but I'm sure we have had students from Lethbridge, Ken, because that does sound familiar, actually.
Yeah, that's fantastic, though. And I mean, and like we said at the start of the interview, I think that the scope and the coverage of the kind of training that you're giving the students is boiling down to their ability to communicate about the work that they're doing there. And it's definitely having kind of a lasting effect, because you're getting students that took the school coming back to do graduate work with you, which is always kind of a nice thing. And so in terms of the kind of, as we have a couple minutes left here, and your research partner might be fading fairly quickly as he sits happily on the lab. What are some of the major things that you've learned so far on the project, and kind of the big takeaways just from the research side of things, and some of the stuff that you guys are going to be driving home next week at the BioArc event?
So we've been very fortunate. I've had some really stellar students who've, you know, stuck with the project through undergrad, and then they come to the field school and they come on as grad students. And so I feel very fortunate we've had such a strong research team. And for us, I think the biggest thing is that we have at Lewisburg, we're sort of in this unique situation where we have this wonderful historic record, and we work constantly with the historian, Sarah McInnes at Parks. And then we also work with the collections manager, Elenise Nightingale, and they really give us this wonderful context on which to build this research. So, you know, as I said, kind of research is secondary to this, you know, trying to protect these burials, but we've had such a great opportunity to kind of talk about these stories. And while there is this great context that we can sort of build on, a lot of it is focused on a very narrow section of the Lewisburg Society. So we're talking about primarily the white affluent males, and we really don't have much of a story when it comes to, you know, women, children, some of the other individuals that were at Lewisburg. And so the research that we focused on, we're trying to tell kind of those individual stories, because so often, you know, the everyday people were not recorded in the historic record. And so we're finally able to talk about, you know, the everyday folks. And I think that that's a big interest for the folks that come to the site, because you can actually come out and watch us work. And a lot of them ask about, you know, who are these people? And, you know, we get to say they're kind of the everyday people. And so in terms of the research, you know, we're looking at how hard life was at Lewisburg. We kind of knew that anyway, but, you know, actually seeing examples of gout, within the skeletal structure, you know, and we know that, of course, they were eating seafood and they were consuming alcohol, you know, the two kind of red flags for developing gout. But actually being able to see that bioarchaeologically is pretty impressive. We've done some really great isotopic research where we're able to actually identify individuals we think might be New Englanders versus French based solely on sort of their diet, which is fascinating because the Rochford Point Cemetery is so big, we don't know if there are sections of the cemetery dedicated to the different occupation periods. And so for us, you know, being able to kind of look at that in a bit more detail is really helpful. You know, we've started to see examples of parasitic infections, not things you necessarily want to think about. You know,
we call those French foreign lesions, right? Is that the
you know, so, you know, we've got, you know, parasitic infections, you know, we've got other types of, you know, just general infections that we're seeing, a lot of dental disease. We know that French dental care really wasn't prominent until the early 19th century. So we can see the repercussions of that in the 18th century and what we're seeing at Lewisburg. So, you know, we're really getting these interesting stories, and we've had the opportunity to do some, like, look at specific individuals and sort of say, okay, this individual was dealing with sort of arthritis, gout, rib fractures. You know, we've got examples of trauma. So, you know, we're getting sort of these more holistic stories about certain individuals, and that we really would never get just with the historic record alone. And so I think that's important, is that, you know, not only are we able to sort of shed light on broadly what's happening at Lewisburg, but we can also talk about individual folks. And that, I don't know, I think that that really makes an important connection between past and present. We can think about our own life stories and what it might look like in 300 years. And then, you know, here we are telling those stories. And I think that's a really important part of what we do. And it makes it relatable to sort of a modern audience, I think.
Yeah. Just in the 2 minutes we've got left then to close out, would you mind telling us about one of those individuals that seemed particularly interesting to you or?
Sure,
you,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I think for us, one of the really interesting ones, and we haven't had a chance to do sort of a full analysis yet, but we have a young female adolescent. And so this individual was probably between 13 to 15 years old. And we did some DNA analysis to confirm that she was female. Most of the individuals in the cemetery are male, and that's based on sort of, we know Lewisburg had a large garrison. So we have this teenage female. We know isotopically that she was born in Lewisburg. So she grew up in Lewisburg. And what's really fascinating is that when we look at her skeletal remains, and what we can say is that we have some pretty impressive activity markers. So this individual, we can see their upper body is very much involved in whatever her everyday activities were. So we can see that she's got well-developed muscles in her upper body, which sort of stands in contrast to what we would expect for women at the time. Primarily, we're doing domestic work. But at Lewisburg, because it was a colony, we know that the women in particular, generally, they were better educated. We had women that were more literate because they really had to contribute to the colony life. And so it's interesting that we have a young female here who seems to be doing more than just simply domestic tasks. But perhaps most interesting with this individual is she has a fairly severe leg fracture. So her upper thigh bone or her femur, we have a very severe leg fracture, and it looks like it probably occurred right around the time of death for her. And unfortunately, you know, we can't really say more than that about the fracture, but we know in modern context, we usually see this type of fracture when an individual has been hit by a car. So we certainly know this young woman wasn't hit by a car, but certainly she had some kind of traumatic event. So whether that was related to her everyday life and what she was doing occupation wise, or some kind of traumatic event, we certainly know this young woman had a life that was a bit different than what we might expect for a young 12-13 year old female living in sort of a colony at the time. So she's a really interesting case study that we're going to do some more work with. But again, it just goes to show that what's missing in the historic record, we might be able to shed some more light on through our bioarchaeological work. And we're really happy we're able to do that.
That's fantastic.
Well, that's great.
And all the 14 and 15 year old skeletons, like 300 years down the road, are going to have this weird, like, kind of humped shoulders and like a curved neck and everything like that. Is that kind of what our future is?
Yes, exactly. And the texting thumbs and everything else.
Yeah, these oversized joints in our thumbs.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for coming on with us, Amy. We're really looking forward to the Skeletal Stories presentation, and I will see you there. We understand your research assistant has another engagement, and we should probably let him go. But we really appreciate you coming on and sharing some information about Lewisburg with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks so much, Amy. That's great.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure. The podcast is really great, and we're just so thrilled that you've asked us to be part of this. We appreciate it, and we hope to see lots of folks out at the event next week. And just quickly, folks can also register online if they're not able to come in person. They can find our Facebook event page and register online. So,
okay, great. We will share that locally here in Lethbridge as well.
Perfect. Thanks so much, fellas.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks so much, Amy. We'll see you later.
Bye.
Take care. Bye. Dr. Molly Moran is an archaeologist working for Parks Canada on the island of Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, where she's based at the Fortress of Lewisburg National Historic Site. Her PhD in anthropology is from the College of William and Mary, and she did a fellowship here at UNB. Her dissertation research drew on archaeological and linguistic evidence to study the travel routes of the Wolastoqiyik through Maine and New Brunswick in the early historic period, and she's also co-authored papers in American Indian Quarterly and in the edited volume Far Northeast, 3000 BP to Contact. Thank you so much for joining us, Mallory.
Yes, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
We wondered if we could start with you telling us a little bit about your role at the Fortress Lewisburg and what Parks does there and sort of what it is for the listener who maybe hasn't visited.
Certainly. So I am the archaeologist for the Cape Breton Field Unit here at Parks Canada. So I'm located here at the Fortress of Lewisburg. But I provide basically archaeological services for all of the Parks Canada properties on Cape Breton Island, which also includes the Cape Breton Highlands National Park, where we've been doing a significant amount of work lately. But historically, my position was 100% dedicated to the Fortress of Lewisburg because the fortress is an extremely large archaeological site and really required the work of many archaeologists through the years as part of its reconstruction and maintenance. So with that, I can tell you a little bit about the history of the Fortress of Lewisburg and you know, why it is a National Historic Site and what people can expect to see if they come visit us today at the fortress. So as you may know, the fortress was a kind of an extremely important place in the struggle between the English and French for control of North America. It was established as a settlement in 1713 when French settlers were moved from Newfoundland to Cape Breton Island as a result of the Treaty of Utrecht when the French lost control of Newfoundland. The French settlers needed somewhere to go. They kind of toured around Cape Breton to try to find a place that would be a good safe harbor to establish a new French stronghold and settled on Lewisburg Harbor as a potential place that had a good opportunity to be easily defended. And their primary concern at this time was a good defense from naval attack and naval warfare. So, with their new settlement site and Lewisburg Harbor, the French hoped to control access to the St. Lawrence Seaway and basically entry into Canada. And, you know, over the years, they were able to establish a very intimidating fortress at Lewisburg, one that was a menace to English colonies all up and down the eastern seaboard. And as a result of the creation of the fortress, you know, it became the site of a lot of conflict as the English attempted to seize control of it and successfully seized control of it twice in its history. So there was a significant battle at the Fortress of Lewisburg in 1745 when the fortress was attacked by kind of a ragtag bunch of New Englanders and was successfully seized. But it was eventually returned to the French and then was subject to another attack and siege in 1758 by English forces. And as a result of this siege in 1758, Louisbourg fell once more to the English and was never reestablished as a French fort. It was eventually systematically demolished in the 1760s and just became farmland where people lived into the 20th century.
That's great. The listener can't see the glimmer in Mallory's eyes when she talked about invading New Englanders, of which she is the latest, I believe, invading New Englander to
I was
to
just going to say, isn't that your guys' band? Like, that's a...
ragtag New Englanders. Yeah. Yes.
And the listener also can't see that Mallory's in like a lab space here with lots of maps of Cape Breton behind her. So she's got like all this reference material very close by.
Yeah. So, I'm here. So we have a very significant library and archives here at the fortress. And it has all of our holdings through the years of all of the archaeological work that's been done to reconstruct the fortress. So in the 1920s and 30s in Canada, there was a resurgence in interest in kind of national identity. And as part of that, there was a desire to explore the ruins of Louisbourg, because they represented such a pivotal time in, the early colonial history here. And so at that time, folks were kind of working on clearing the ruins and stabilizing the ruins that still existed. But it really wasn't until the 1960s when Louisbourg became funded as basically kind of a make work project for coal miners in Cape Breton who had been laid off after the collapse of the coal mining industry. To actually systematically excavate the fortress ruins and then rebuild a reconstruction. So as a result of that, there was an enormous amount of archaeological work completed. Where I'm sitting right now is where all of the artifacts and all the records from that work are stored.
Fantastic. So, Mallory, could you tell us how many nails are in the boxes behind you?
Actually, okay. So we have so many nails, actually, that they're not even stored in this building. So I misspoke when I said all of the materials. We have a very significant collection of nails. If you visit Louisbourg and you come look at the King's Bastion, you don't have access to this just as a regular visitor, but actually the entire attic of that building is full of nails. So we have thousands and thousands of nails.
I talk to my students about like the curation crisis and stuff like that. And one of the things that I pose to them is like, what do you do when you have like millions of nails? Like, what do you do with these things? And where do you find places for them? Where do you make decisions about when you're keeping, where they get kept and everything like that? So these are all sorts of like kind of nuanced challenges that, in a massive national historic site like this that you would have. And so you talked kind of an interesting, I think there's sort of an interesting shift in Louisbourg from kind of a resource management perspective, in that you know, it was sort of founded and reconstructed, which was kind of a big drive in the mid 20th century. And then in kind of the new age of when we think about resource management, we think about national historic sites and what Parks Canada is doing with that. How is Fortress Louisbourg kind of factoring into kind of this new approach to how we preserve, interpret, and kind of share information about a place like Fortress Louisbourg, and why the project that Amy and her team and UNB are taking on, and why you guys partnered with them?
Yeah, we certainly face a lot of challenges as a National Historic Site and located where we are right on the coastline. Challenges that, were recognized back in the 60s when the reconstruction was first ongoing, but have certainly accelerated in recent years. So as I'm sure you've encountered with other folks working in the Maritimes, coastal erosion as a result of climate change is a major problem for us here at the fortress. In recent years, we've seen the rate of impact from climate change to be accelerating with our latest major hurricane, Fiona, which basically directly hit the fortress. We were observing that we were losing upwards of 10 to 20 meters of coastal sediment just from that single storm. And, our job at Parks is to preserve to the best of our ability this history that's so important to all Canadians, and to present it in ways that reflect, the most truthful telling of what's happened at Louisbourg as we can. And so when we're faced with the issue of the loss of the historical record, loss of the archaeological record, we really have to work hard to find solutions that will enable us to save as much of that history as we can. And that's why this partnership with Dr. Scott at UNB has been so amazing, because as I'm sure she mentioned, the Rochford Point Burial Ground is one of the most exposed areas along the coastline and is, you know, rapidly falling into the ocean, for lack of a better word. And so being able to partner with her means that not only are we able to kind of save these people who are eroding out into the ocean, but we're also able to learn from the work that she and her team are doing about the lives of people who were interred there. And it gives us a view into the lives of people at Lewisburg that we don't get in any other way. So we do have, we're very fortunate to have a lot of written records about Lewisburg, primarily administrative records. And we're also fortunate to have had such extensive excavations, but those excavations have focused by and large on the very wealthy sections of the town right next to the quay and the port, where you would have had the administration living and wealthy merchants living. And so we really get a different view of what life was like by seeing, you know, the stories we can learn about people from the skeletal remains that Amy's able to recover.
Do you get a sense that some of the interpretive stuff at the park and at the National Historic Site, over time, you'll get to kind of include some of this data as part of kind of the broader interpretation? Like, it's really great that these kind of individualized stories, I think, are kind of like incredibly fascinating. I can just imagine sort of people visiting Lewisburg and being able to hear about, this person and like, you know, kind of how their work day was and see somebody kind of reenacting that, but also them being able to communicate like I'm representing this kind of person. And this is this like what we saw in their skeletal remains. And this is how we understood their kind of daily lives to be like. I see that as being kind of a really exciting thing. Just kind of before we wrap, is that that's kind of stuff that you guys are excited about? How do you see this project kind of unfolding in the future and what it's, how it's going to be integrated to the, at the site itself?
Definitely. We have costumed interpreters on site who basically connect with visitors and allow them to have an interactive experience where they talk about what life was like in the 18th century, and being able to draw from these specific examples of the kinds of labor people were engaging in, what their health was like, will really kind of change those interpretive experiences for folks and give them a fuller picture of what life was like. So that will be really powerful. I think we are interested in incorporating what we learn in all sorts of ways, like through exhibits, through panels. And so we're really excited at the chance to be able to incorporate some of these findings across the site.
Well, thank you so much, Mallory. We really appreciate you coming on with us. We're very excited to talk about this with you and to hear more about your work at the Skeletal Stories event coming up here at the Harriet Irving Library. So thank you for tuning in and joining us, Mallory.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
No, thanks so much for having me. It's been really great to chat with you guys.
Great chatting with you, Mallory. Thanks so much. Thank you so much for joining us, Nicole Hughes. Nicole is a PhD student here at the University of New Brunswick, prior to which she was a master's student here at the University of New Brunswick. And prior to that, she got her BSc at Brandon University. And she has a number of publications, which I'm going to get her to send us links to and also to describe in a moment. And she also teaches for us here at UNB. How are you doing, Nicole?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Absolutely.
We wondered if you could tell our listeners a little bit what your thesis work is about and what your research interests more broadly are.
Sure, that sounds great. Well, my PhD research that I'm conducting looks at kinship among archaeological human remains buried at the St. Marie Mass Burial, which is located at the Fortress of Lewisburg. And the individuals buried in this mass burial were New Englanders who came up to Lewisburg in 1745. And I'm specifically using a kin-making lens, which comes from queer and indigenous archaeological research, to understand how kin was created and also maintained among the New Englander population. So for this research, I'm going to be extracting DNA to reconstruct genetic relatedness, and I'll also be looking at other types of evidence, such as burial goods and stable isotopes and mortuary patterns, to reconstruct social relatedness. And therefore, when you put genetic and social relatedness together, this can be holistically used to interpret kinship in the archaeological past.
It's fantastic.
That's fantastic. That's a real merger of kind of classic anthropological high theory with very high end science. I like that.
Yeah, I was going to say that's really neat. It's like it's bio, but really truly bioanthropology.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredibly interdisciplinary. It's very bio heavy, but also this quite amazing lens to be looking at the past through. I'm very excited about it.
But your skeletal story, I understand, is actually even more painful than trying to reconstruct kinship anthropologically. It's an amputation.
The listener doesn't know, but the show note that Gabe put in for our interview with Nicole is just leg amputation, which I'm quite excited to hear about.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome. Yes. So for this case study, I collaborated with Dr. Amy Scott and Dan Pitcher. Dan Pitcher works at Parks Canada, and Dr. Amy Scott is my supervisor. And we recently published a paper on this individual, actually. So I decided to present on them at Skeletal Stories. Among the New Englanders in the St. Mary Mass burial, there was a young male, and he was about 20 years of age when he died. And he sustained a lower leg surgical amputation. So just below the knee, his leg was cut off with a bone saw, and he likely died from this traumatic event.
That certainly sounds like a traumatic event indeed. And could you send us the publication so we can put it in the show notes and promote that work?
Cheeky comment that you are the first mention of bone saw on our nice. Our podcast. So that's
there's actually a podcast called Bone Saw and it's or Bone Saws, and it's really, really good. It's about medical history. Anyway, yeah, it's phenomenal.
Interesting. Oh, okay. Well, fantastic.
Yeah. So we can't take that name, Gabe.
We can't. Not even for this one. We could see if they want to do a crossover, though. They probably have more listeners than we do.
They probably
do. Maybe a couple more.
But Nicole, you've done a lot of other work at Lewisburg, too. And so we'll get you to also send us some of that research to put in the show notes. But I thought maybe just to fit this in broadly in the interest of time, we'd ask, why are you a bioarchaeologist? What is it that got you into bioarchaeology? What are your research interests moving forward? What do you like doing what you're doing?
I love bioarchaeology because it has this beautiful relationship between biology and human skeletal remains, as well as interpreting our shared human past. Bioarchaeology has this magnificent way of highlighting voices and people's stories from the past who are rarely revealed through historical studies alone, or rarely represented in historical literature, particularly people of non-power identities. I'm especially interested in the stories of women and children from the past, as well as people from, you know, lower socioeconomic statuses or positions in society who may not have been written about. Their common life may not have been discussed or recorded in history. So those people, we are able to interpret their lived experiences through bioarchaeology and try to kind of understand how they lived and in what way they died, which I find fascinating.
So do you have a particular individual that you've like met or engaged with at Fortress Lewisburg that you want to share a story about?
So there's one individual from the Fortress of Lewisburg Skeletal Collection. They are quite a young individual, around 13 years of age, and we did biological sex analysis on them through DNA, and it turns out this person is biologically female, and she died quite young, but she sustained a very traumatic injury to her femur, which is her thigh bone, and the trauma she sustained likely happened around the time of death. So she may have died from this fracture in her thigh bone. But this fracture in her thigh bone and other indicators on her skeleton suggest that she was engaging in quite tough labor and was not conforming to standard gender roles as we put on people in the past. So, you know, we understand women and girls in the past as being very domestic, engaging in very domestic chores, being quite stationary, being associated with the home, especially in a colonial context. But clearly this young woman, this young girl, was not. She was engaging in quite strenuous labor, and she was engaging in some sort of event that led to a very traumatic injury to her thigh, which she likely died from.
That's really interesting. And thanks for sharing that, Nicole. We noticed that this is a popular one, and Amy actually was describing parts of that with us as well. But I think it just shows how striking that example is.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It seems to be front of mind for everyone on the research team. Well, we really appreciate you coming on to share your story as a bioarchaeologist and some of your work. And we know our listeners will look forward to reading about some of your work. So please send it along and we'll put it in the show notes.
Absolutely. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, Nicole.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Anytime. You're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So we're joined now by Taylor Corbett, who is a master's student with Amy here at the University of New Brunswick. Prior to that, she got her degree at the University of Toronto, where we just learned that our very own Ken Holyoake may have been her teaching assistant. We're not sure, but it seems possible that he was. How are you today, Taylor?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you.
Thank you for coming on the show.
No problem. And I apologize in advance, Ken, if you ever had to read anything I wrote when I was 18, it was probably atrocious.
We're all forgiven for what we wrote when we were 18.
Yeah. I mean, Ken's problem was he actually didn't write anything when he was 18. That's why he had to change majors.
Exactly.
So Taylor, we wondered if you could just start by telling us a little bit about yourself, in particular, what your research interests are, what's your thesis about, and what your work's on.
All right, sounds like a plan. So, as you know, I'm a master's student and I'm doing biowork with Amy. And I'm looking at, for my thesis, fractures from the Fortress of Lewisburg skeletal collection. So we're basically mostly looking at the physical impact of these fractures on the individuals who sustain them. And then I get to do some really fun imaging technology using micro-CT. So it basically allows us to look inside of any of the healed fractures to see how healed they actually are. So I did that with Dr. Andrew Nelson over at Western. And we imaged some rib bones. So I get to talk a little bit more in depth about fracture healing, which can help us talk about sometimes like medical practices. So understanding how things healed and how healed they were able to be before an individual passed.
That's great. And I understand at the Skeletal Stories event, you're going to be telling us a bit about surgeons' reports and about broken bones at Lewisburg.
I will. So I'm going to do just a small portion of what I've been working on with my thesis, because all of it won't really fit into 5 minutes, but we're mostly going to talk about what fractures were present, how those fractures may have occurred, so what those fracture risks are at the fortress, and a little bit about treatments. That's where those fun surgeons reports come in, and we can kind of see what fractures were happening based on firsthand accounts and see if that matches with what we're actually seeing on the bones.
Some of the most common injuries and fractures that you would see on skeletal remains from Lewisburg?
So originally, like, our most common kind of fractures that we see are rib bones, fingers and toes, and then sometimes arms, which is what we are seeing at Lewisburg. So that's good. Everything matches. But we actually have fractures from almost every part of the body, excluding the pelvis. But everywhere else, we found at least one fracture, which is kind of crazy.
Interesting. So what do you think is causing like rib bones specifically? Is it just that they break fairly easily, or is it like that there's particular types of impacts and trauma that would cause rib bones to be the things that break most frequently?
Honestly, rib bones are a lot smaller and they're a lot less dense because you're trying to hold them up. They're just meant to be like a little protective layer around all of your organs. They're not meant to support any like body weight or anything. So we see those break a lot easier because they are a lot thinner and smaller, but it's also a common place for impacts to happen. So like, think about how many times you've been like hit in the gut. That kind of thing happens pretty frequently with ribs. You can also get broken ribs from falls, which I'm sure happened pretty frequently at the fortress. So we can see that quite a bit. Also brawling, so like fighting, that's a pretty common place to throw a punch. So that could be another reason why we see a lot of broken rib bones.
Interesting.
Right. So that sounds like that's some of the insight into day-to-day life you're getting at Lewisburg from this. Yeah. But is there a particular anecdote or a particular way that this connects to the broader project?
Just like even going through some of like the soldiers' journals that we do have available, there are a lot of accounts of soldiers accidentally falling off the walls, a lot of the time due to extreme inebriation. They have more taverns than people, it seemed, at the fortress. So being inebriated was a day-to-day occurrence, which can lead to a lot of unwanted accidents and injuries.
Oh, wow.
It's good public health advice here, listener.
I was going to say, yeah, some of these rib injuries were maybe ones related to going off a defensive wall or something, eh? Yeah.
It's a Courvoisier-related accident right there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. But we thought we'd leave the listener with just, why are you a bioarchaeologist? What is it that got you into this? What do you love about it?
Okay, so I started in forensic anthropology, which is what I did at U of T. And I enjoyed it a lot, and it's something I will definitely continue to pursue in the future. But it's a lot, especially when you're working with more recent human remains. So I decided to do biowork for my master's as kind of like to see what the other side looks like, essentially. And I found that I really, really like it. It's a lot of problem solving, and there's a lot of different areas of research that you can pursue. So like for me, I'm doing trauma right now, but I also really like paleopath, and like isotope analysis is really cool. So you have basically endless possibilities to look at in bioarc, and there's a lot of field opportunities, which I would much prefer to sitting at a desk. So I think bioarc is honestly really great.
That's fantastic.
Yep. Thank you so much for joining us, Taylor, and we're looking forward to seeing your presentation at the Skeletal Stories event.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me.
We're joined now by Nicole Bruden, who just finished, I think last year, her master's here at the University of New Brunswick, and now is working for the Rural Development Institute at Brandon University. How are you, Nicole?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on today.
We really appreciate you. Yeah, we really appreciate you making the time. We wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, what your thesis was about, and what are your research interests now?
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Amy Scott was my supervisor, and my thesis focused on assessing patterns of bacterial bioerosion, a specific type of bone degeneration resulting from the human microbiome. For this project, micro-CT technology was used to capture images and analyze the skeletal remains of non-adults to propose a new method for identifying bacterial bioerosion. While I'm still involved within the world of biological anthropology and bioarchaeology, my research interests have pivoted a little since my graduation in 2022. So as Gabe had mentioned, I currently work at the Rural Development Institute. It's a research center based at Brandon University in Manitoba. The work conducted through RDI focuses on supporting development, building community capacity, and informing policymakers on solutions for rural realities. But my research interests specifically are within the field of tourism and tourism policy as it relates to archaeology and bioarchaeology.
That's very cool. And that's what you're presenting on at Bioarchaeology Night at the Skeletal Stories program. Is that right?
Yes. So throughout the field season of 2023, Dr. Amy Scott and the Parks Canada Cape Breton unit granted their permission for me to conduct tourism research at the Fortress of Louisbourg on behalf of RDI. This project was designed to identify the interests of tourists visiting the bioarchaeological site at the Fortress of Louisbourg, as well as their experience at the fortress overall. Because the fortress is located both rurally and remotely on Cape Breton Island, it's the hope that this data would be useful in highlighting how other rural and remote communities could highlight currently sustained community assets to attract new tourists. This would allow communities to passively engage in the tourism sector without needing to invest more on resources or infrastructure. So within the presentation, I'll be reviewing some major findings of the surveys in relation to the interests of the fortress guests and as tourists within Canada.
That's great. That's really interesting. It's a different angle than I think we usually think about archaeology from. And so how does this contribute though, to the broader project, which I think is really, really interesting because we were talking to Mallory a little bit about the interpretive aspect. So you've got, I guess, the different perspective on it. You've got who it's being interpreted for.
Yeah. It was really, really fun to engage with the public in this way. I think the research really showcases the importance of collaboration between stakeholders within the field of tourism and archaeology. So due to our amazing relationships with Parks Canada, we've been able to share so much with students, guests visiting the fortress, and the public throughout all these various projects. The main finding that really came to light throughout this project in particular was that there is an opportunity to reach an unmet market. Within the tourism sector, it's been expressed that not many folks avidly seek the opportunities to experience or learn about cultural or historic heritage. But there was evidence of a deep-seated interest among travelers to learn more about the cultural heritage and history of what is now Canada. The Fortress of Louisbourg offers a really unique opportunity and experiences for tourists that really isn't available in other locations. And the goal now, based on this project, is to make sure that the public is aware that these opportunities are available to them.
That's really interesting, because I think we actually kind of always think that people seek these places out, eh? Like, it's sort of surprising that that's like, it's not something that comes to people's top of mind, right? That these sorts of places need a little bit more promotion. But I guess we've learned through this show too, that like we do a very poor job of kind of sharing archaeological information and kind of sharing about the past. So maybe that is part of it.
Yeah, this might actually be something we should do as a longer program with Nicole sometime about how are we pitching this wrong, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's important too, because, you know, it's getting at this tie-in with rural communities as well, and it's getting people to remote places. And there are a lot of those kinds of communities in Canada that I think would probably draw on this kind of information.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there are historic and cultural heritage sites all over Canada. Most of them, like you had mentioned, are located rurally and remotely. And especially within the archaeological context, I feel like these opportunities can really allow for more interaction and knowledge translation to the public. And there is interest in seeing it and seeing the work being done and learning about the methods. One survey participant in particular had noted that they were really excited to be able to see this work being done in real time, because a lot of the times as academics, the work is done and then we report on it. Like, it's not really accessible for the public in real time. And that was a main source of interest for them. So yeah, I think that this definitely represents a new opportunity, or maybe not new, but just emphasizing the importance of having these opportunities available.
Yeah, not just public archaeology, but publicly accessible archaeology, like stuff that people can actually like tangibly observe.
Yeah, and obviously that poses a lot of different concerns in terms of securing a site. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done in that regard. But I think that it is an important step forward to kind of bridge the gap between the public and the academic work being done, for sure.
Fantastic.
That's super interesting research. And but we've been asking everyone, how did you get into bioarchaeology or this aspect of bioarchaeology? And so why do you like doing this? Tell us about your story.
Yeah, definitely. I had a lot of very serendipitous experiences throughout the early stages of my academic career. I wasn't entirely sure on what the end goal was, but I was always looking for opportunities to kind of feel out where my interests really lied. I signed up as a student for the first field season at the Fortress of Louisbourg. And in that 1 month, I really just fell in love with the work. This project in particular is based on such a meaningful mission and a relevant mission with consideration to coastal erosion and the exposure of remains and artifacts. And I feel like that made it so much more important to me personally. And alongside the mission in and of itself, working in the field of bioarchaeology requires a really wild balance between the meticulous application of standardized methods and procedures while addressing so much variability within any given site. There's always something new and different being uncovered, and it's really incredible to see how we all adapt to those situations to ensure the work is done properly and thoroughly, given the circumstances that present themselves throughout the duration of the field season. I feel like I'm always learning and building on my skills, which is really fulfilling. And I think finally, I have to say, being able to work with the team in particular, the members of Parks Canada, to be able to engage students as they enroll in the program, it's just a lot of fun. I'm now based in Manitoba, but I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to come back and work with all of these amazing people each summer. Right now, I'm in a position where I can balance between my full-time position at BU and coming back to the Fortress of Louisbourg, and I'm going to hopefully maintain that balance for as long as possible.
That seems that's like the awesome. Best of both worlds.
Yeah, definitely is. Yeah,
no, that's great.
Yeah.
That's really interesting research. And too, and Ken and I have noticed that when a bioarchaeologist says that there was serendipity involved in their career, it usually means something good. When an archaeologist says it means they flunk calculus too. It's a subtle distinction.
That's my story.
Well, Nicole, we really appreciate you coming on, and we hope that we suspect that this tourism work you're doing will end up published or reported somewhere. And when it does, we think our listeners would be very interested in seeing it, as would we. So please send it along, and we'll put it in a future show note.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, that would be great. I'm hoping to have something drafted up for UNB and Parks Canada within the month. So hopefully it'll be sooner rather than later.
That's fantastic.
Fantastic. We can't wait. And thank you so much for making the time to join us. And we're looking forward to seeing your presentation at Skeletal Stories.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Have a good afternoon.
You too. All right. So we are joined now by Kelsey Kane, who is a University of New Brunswick master's student working with Amy Scott. And prior to that, got her BSc at Lakehead. And we understand she's currently joining us from the foot of a ski slope somewhere in Quebec. Is that right, Kelsey?
Yes, that is correct. I'm in Mont Saint-Anne.
Oh, excellent. Very nice. Yeah, and that seems so appropriate for an evening about wear and tear on one's bones, I think. So this, at least with my...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Perfect. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself? So what's your thesis about and what are your research interests?
Yeah. So like you said, I'm a second year master's student working with Amy. And broadly, my research interests are human osteology, paleopathology, so the disease in bones and the musculoskeletal system as a whole. I really like learning about the ways that our physical reality, so like our jobs and the activities we like to do, leave its mark on the skeleton. I think that's really cool. So my thesis is about looking at muscle attachment sites on the bones in individuals from the fortress, and we're assessing activity level to try and see what kind of impact the occupations had on these individuals' bodies. So we know from historic records and previous research that life at Lewisburg was pretty crappy. And especially the physical labor, it was very, very difficult. So for my research specifically, Lewisburg presents a really unique opportunity because most individuals from archaeological populations are hundreds of years old, of course, and don't have any modern proxies to compare to. Lewisburg is really great because they have historic interpreters who reenact what life was like in the 18th century as if it's the 18th century. So they use the same tools and techniques, which is a huge gift for this type of research because I'm able to implement modern techniques and methods from other disciplines that have never been used in bioarchaeology, because usually we don't have a living population to compare it to. So I'm actually working with Dr. Seaman in the kinesiology department here at UMB to use surface electromyography, which is just EMG. It's typically used in biomechanics and kinesiology and like exercise science. And basically it just measures the amount of force that a muscle is producing during a specific movement or task. So essentially what it tells us is how much of a muscle's maximum capability. So the maximum amount that that muscle can produce, it tells us what percentage was used during a task. So we can then look and see how much of that was put onto the bone.
Is this like one of these things where they attach all these nodes to you and you're running on a treadmill kind of thing?
Exactly. Yeah. So we attach.
So they do this with Ken and I. It's a cardiac stress test because of our lifestyle. Yeah. But they, yeah.
Yeah. We were looking at the deltoid, like your shoulders, and we attached the electrodes to them. And I was like, okay, go chop a bunch of wood. Let's see what happens, basically. So we had them reenact what the activities that they would have been doing with the electrodes stuck to them.
Oh, wow. I feel like this is like a pending like workers' compensation case for all these people that are doing these historic reenactments. Like
they all signed.
I have the same bones as somebody in the 17th century. Like,
yeah, they all volunteered. So I'm in the clear at least.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. And you're going to present on this at the Skeletal Stories presentation.
Yes, I am. I'm excited. I think it's going to be really fun. I'm going to be, you know, going over it probably a little more in depth, go over what occupations we looked at, what are the preliminary results are at this point, kind of stuff like that. But it's going to be a really cool night, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. And could you just to sort of tell us a little bit about how your work fits into the broader project? Could you just outline some of the sort of occupations you're looking at and what this kind of work? I mean, like, since they're reenactors, it's sort of clear how this ties into the broader interpretation. But I'm curious what sort of occupations you're studying.
About life at Lewisburg, it tells us that it kind of corroborates what the historical records tell us, because they convey that life is really difficult. And so it gives us a better understanding of what life was physically like at Lewisburg. It's able to tell us that people were working so hard under such harsh conditions that it left physical marks on their bones, which I think is pretty remarkable. And physical reality, of course, plays a huge role in somebody's lived experience. Like if you're going through your day-to-day life with a pulled muscle, or you haven't eaten in 2 days, or you haven't slept, or you're exhausted, all of those things are going to impact somebody's life. So using the interdisciplinary approach allows us to dive a little bit deeper into that, into ways that we couldn't before. So we did that by basically looking at occupations that would have really engaged your shoulder muscles in the deltoid, because that's the muscle attachment that we're focusing on for the skeleton itself. And because it's a huge muscle that inserts into one small point on the arm. So we looked at rowing, we looked at fishing, hand lining, the processing of the cods, because it was a big cod fishery at Lewisburg. We looked at masonry, we looked at blacksmithing, carpentry, wood chopping, lots of wood chopping. Yeah, there's a lot. They do a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, this is great. I walk by the grad office sometimes and the grad students will all be in a bad mood. And then Kelsey just says, well, it could be worse. We could be chained to an oar somewhere in Cape Breton. and so that's all really great. And I'm super excited to see that. Actually, I was telling Ken, I really enjoyed your thesis proposal because it was something just very different. Also a little less gross than many biological anthropology thesis proposals are.
Yeah. There's a distinctive reason why Gabe and I don't generally do this sort of work.
Exactly.
And it's like, I will fully admit, I don't know if I have the comportment for it. It's like,
yeah, it's easier when you know that all their loved ones are long gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Compartmentalized a little bit.
I'm not sure if it could be. I'm going to talk about this with Amy tomorrow. Like, I don't know if I'd like bones.
I tell myself at least.
And so I guess just actually on that note, we were going to wrap up with just asking you, why are you a bioarchaeologist? So what got you into this? What do you like about it? Tell us your story about bioarchaeology.
Yeah. So I did the field school as a student that Amy offers every year back in 2019. And I had just graduated my undergrad and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. And then I did the field school and I was like, well, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. This is the coolest thing ever. So I think what really stood out to me about it is that I think it's really important to advocate for the individuals from the past that are often overlooked in historical contexts. So being able to share knowledge and the techniques of how to do that ethically in the way that I was taught is really important. In the case of Lewisburg, especially because it's a fight against the clock to preserve these individuals before themselves and their histories are washed away by the Atlantic. Of course, I love excavating, playing in the dirt, being in the field. I'm sure you guys can relate to that. But for me, it's kind of twofold because I really like that you're able to go from excavation to lab and be able to really learn a lot about somebody and their life just from their skeleton. So I think I love that as bioarchaeologists, we're able to try and help give a small voice back to somebody who doesn't have it anymore. I just think it's really cool.
That's very cool. It's very intimate too, eh?
Yeah, it's so cool. Well, it's somebody's body. Like, it's a person, right? It's their life. It's what's left of them. So it's really special that you're able to say something about it, right?
Absolutely. Well, that's great, Kelsey. Thank you so much for taking a little bit of time away from your ski trip to talk with us tonight. And I'm really looking forward to seeing your thesis and your presentation at the Skeletal Stories Night. And shoot us a line. We're told that there will eventually be a paper related to this. So shoot us a line when it's out and we'll drop it in the show notes for our listeners. So I'm sure we'll love to hear more. Thank you so much, Kelsey.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much.
We're joined now by Chris Burgess, who is a graduate of the University of New Brunswick and now is a master's student here. How are you, Chris?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it. So Chris, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, what your thesis is about? What your research interests are?
So first year here so far, kind of looking into various geophysical techniques that can be applied to archaeological sites. So like other ones, my main area of interest is Fortress Lewisburg, specifically the Rochefort Point site. And essentially it's just testing several well-known geophysical applications on this site and determining which one yields the most accurate results just to help progress the research out on the point itself.
That's great. And so for our listener, could you tell us a little bit about what it is that those geophysical techniques do, right? So as non-invasive methods and all that.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that component of it. It doesn't involve any kind of excavation work, any site damage or anything like that. So it's all surface level kind of examination. So the main one that most people know about is ground penetrating radar, so GPR. The other ones that we're looking at, we did some magnetic susceptibility and gradiometry, magnetometry, just different applications that pick up different things. So on the point itself, there's houses and cemeteries and all this kind of stuff all jumbled together. And then these applications kind of just go over the surface in kind of a grid pattern, either picking up magnetic signals from subsurface objects, or kind of just like the energy in the soil itself. It represents kind of voids or cavities, which would typically be burials, mostly magnetic stuff. You're picking up rocks. So rocks give a much larger magnetic signal than kind of the soil that surrounds them in most cases. So you'll see those, and they kind of present either as a, like a line view. You're looking down, you can see these voids or what these might be, or when you then render it into kind of a map view, and you can kind of go through the depths and kind of visualize what's there prior to excavating. And it just helps us, in theory, focus where our research should be. And the site is eroding on both sides. So it's just kind of to narrow in the window of where we should dedicate our resources first, essentially.
That's great. And so do you have any, you said you're just in the first year of the program, but it sounds like you've got some experience with this. So have you gone out and done some field work already? Do you have any like kind of preliminary results, or get a sense which of the techniques you think is probably going to be the most effective for your research?
Yeah. So in 2021, we did some magnetic susceptibility readings on the burial shafts themselves. So essentially, once the sod layer has been removed by the excavator and we could see burial shafts, we took readings prior to any bones being exposed. We took more readings. It's just a little handheld device, essentially. And we took more readings when the bones are exposed and then after the bones have been removed and we're kind of at that till level, the natural soil. So we did that to be in the beginning just to see if any of these methods would work. So if all the soil is extremely magnetic out there, there is an iron pan out there, it's glacial till, we don't know what kind of magnetic signals they would give. So if everything was too magnetic in the beginning, it wouldn't even be worth trying these other methods. All you'd see is just a big red screen, essentially. So the readings would be too large. So everything looked good on that sense. So the following year, so last year we went out and did, prior to the field school itself, so the UNB field school in July, we went out and surveyed quite a large swath of this cemetery site that hasn't been excavated yet using all these methods. And then the same year, the actual excavations happened. So that's the data that we're comparing it to, the true archaeological data that was collected. So it looks like preliminarily that the GPR data, as theorized, is going to produce a better idea of where burials themselves are, picks up that kind of that void cavity that's been buried in. And then the magnetic and radiometric data is picking up a lot of foundations that we didn't know were out there. So we're seeing quite rectangular, kind of definitely anthropogenic, either dugout shafts of where cellar features would be, or some shallow stone or wooden walled features that we can't see at the surface. And we didn't know they were actually there. There's no maps of them up there. So it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of grave outlines being in that. Obviously, again, we're just in the preliminary phases of it. We haven't actually gone through and rendered the data fully yet, but just a quick scan over it. It's looking like one's picking up mostly architectural and the other one's picking up mostly cemetery remains. So it's
very cool.
Gives us two different things, I guess.
And so your project then, it sounds like, fits in both to the bioarchaeological work and the historical archaeology work potentially at Lewisburg.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of ties nicely. It's dedicated essentially, the project is for bioarch stuff, but the other information that we can gather from it is just going to help build to the story and help parks in the long run, right?
That's great.
So, yeah. An interesting methodological piece too, like just sort of comparing the two on the same, basically the same run over, but different data sets producing different results.
Yeah, and exactly. And it's nice that, I mean, this stuff happens all the time, right? Like these methods aren't new. They're well known in most archaeological sites, especially like in Europe, where there's lots of Roman architecture and things have been around for thousands of years that are stone built, really. So it's nice to have something here that it's on a historic site. We know there's a cemetery, and you're essentially ground truthing the information you see in these geophysical techniques to the true data that you're finding in the ground. So it's nice to be able to see that. And we collect data in the field as we remove these individuals, and you know, depth data, size of burial shafts, locations, and all that kind of stuff. And then we can just overlay those onto these geophysical maps that we're creating and just identify what's true and what's misrepresented by the geophysical type.
So that's great. And I imagine it'll be super useful for other folks doing just other kinds of work in the region, right?
Yeah, it's hopefully, yeah, the idea is to, I mean, for coastal sites specifically, you know, they're the most at risk. And if it's an easy thing that you can just, instead of test pitting 1,000 test pits, if you can do a quick survey and identify something quicker, then that helps everyone. So
that's great.
Certainly.
So how'd you get into this kind of bioarchaeology? This is, I think this is not exactly what everyone thinks about when they are passionate about bioarchaeology is let's drag a big piece of equipment that looks like a baby carriage over an archaeological site.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, mine was a sleigh. I wish it was a carriage, but
a sleigh.
A little more dragging through rather than rolling along. But I'll start with Dr. Scott, actually. So it was just more of like an invite to come up to help, essentially, in one field season. And then I was already doing, I had already finished an archaeology degree here, and then I was still working on my geology degree, and kind of just realized that there is applications between the two disciplines, and that, yeah, it's known in certain areas, but it's only recently in the past few years that it's been really emphasized on cemetery sites, especially with residential schools. So it's, I feel like it's an interesting field to expand on, and more research can be done. And like I said, it's more so for the idea that you can figure something out before it's gone. You know, I feel like that's always the case with archaeology, right? You're kind of rushing against time, and there's never enough of us to figure out before it's really gone. So even if you have like the map, maybe we can get to the actual site, but now we know what it looks like, and you know, we can dedicate resources to that. Or if there's no resources to get dedicated, at least you have an idea of what you're losing and how that fits into the history around it. So yeah, that's pretty well it. That's how I fell into this, I guess.
Good way to fall into something. So, and sounds like very interesting research.
It does. Yeah. So thanks very much for joining us, Chris. We're really looking forward to seeing your presentation on reinforcing Rochefort Point, coastal management strategies and geoarchaeological techniques at the 18th century fortress of Lewisburg. And so I know our listeners will also be interested once your thesis comes out about any future papers this is what I do here as a member of the GIU is encourage this. I get the students to it's some kind of motivation, isn't it? Where if you like make a promise in front of the entire listenership of the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, you're more committed to finishing your thesis.
Exactly.
So Chris, we're really looking forward to your talking. But when papers or your thesis or conference presentations come out about this, please let us know and we'll drop it in the show notes when that happens. But we appreciate you coming on with us.
Hey, no problem. That's great.
Yeah.
Great to be able to talk about it. So thanks for having me again.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Chris. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, you too.